Blog Talk Radio.
Tell my baby, make it hot. Rise the cop, till you hit the spot. Tell my baby, make it hot.
Doing it doggy style. Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yo. Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yo.
Hello, Professor Val here, and Dr. Mark is somewhere. I see he's signed on, but I don't hear him. Hopefully it's not the phone lines here. We have a really awesome guest tonight. So we'll talk to you a little bit more about him in a minute. All right, Mark chiming in. I am on the air alone. Let's see. I'm going to see what happens here. You know, this is a should be a regular part of the show where I'm all alone. He is alive. Hello, are you here? All right. Well, while we're waiting, let's see. Oh, jeez. All right. My assistant is writing and saying that there's a typo. There's always a typo. Okay, well, Dr. Mark hears me, but we can't hear him. Why don't you hang up and call back in, dear? That would be nice. All right? All right. He's cursing in Italian. All right, you guys watching what's going on with Obama and McCain going back and forth today, one wanting to end the campaigning for now to head back to Washington and see what's going on and how he can help, and the other saying, yeah, well, that's important and we need to talk and get on the same page, but we should also not be stopping the campaigning. So I don't know what's happening with that just yet. Hopefully these guys will work it out and they'll be on the same page. And let's see. Oh, he's calling back in. Let us see. Let's see. Okay. Are you there?
Am I there?
You are here. You are. I don't know what happened before.
Whatever. You know, with this freaking thing.
I knew. I do. I know. It's
The expletives were flying on this end of the phone a minute ago.
Well, I couldn't hear you, so I guess it didn't matter.
Yeah, well, again, I'm ignored. I'll get over it.
Yeah, well, yeah, you should be used to that. Wait a minute. Maybe we should do this here. Let's see.
At 11, pay more at the grocer, but getting less will tell you how to get the most. The fuck are you doing?
Barely here, but I hear you
talk.
Still.
Yeah, poor Sue. All right, so I'm watching the Mets game, and I'm getting agita.
A line drive to the right center. Rounding second. Ooh, a two-out hit for the Philo. I'm telling you, I think my little trick that I injected there in the chat room on the Mike Silver broadcast before might work.
Yeah?
Little fan feng shui going on. Yeah, between pitches, you just close your eyes. And you listen. And if the Philos would do that actually between at-bats during the game, they would put themselves in the center of their surroundings rather than the edge where you are visually, see? Gives you a more sense of being supportive and balanced, which, of course, the Philos need as the eco leaves the mound.
Yes,
this eco's wild. You see this eco in Zambrano? All he's yelling at imaginary people. He's out of his mind.
Well, that's eco for you. Speaking of, I think your phone's a little eco tonight. You're sounding a little muffled.
You want me to call in again?
Like it sounds like you're talking through your crotch.
Well, I do that mostly out of my ass during the day, but
for now.
All right, I'm calling back for the third freaking time. Goodbye.
All right, well, we'll be waiting. Blog Talk is actually really good. It's just every once in a while we have some glitches here and there, and I think that time it was Dr. Mark's phone directly. Okay, he's about calling back in here. Let's see. Oh, that's not going to work yet. All right. Let's see here. All right, well, when he gets back, remind me. We have to tell you who's on the show tonight and all that good stuff. And a shout-out to my faithful assistant who's listening from another country. Hello, darling. Oh, no, he's still not calling back in. I think his phone is possessed. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. Everything else in that office is possessed. Let's see. Hello?
I'm back. 905.
You're still not so good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me see if I can get some feedback from someone else who's listening, and let me type here. Actually, I don't have to type. Could you give me some feedback? How does Dr. Mark sound on the line there? Say something, Dr. Mark.
Testing. Testing all XOs. Testing. I mean, what the hell? I hate this freaking phone game.
You don't sound good. Yeah.
Well, would you rather me not say anything?
No. I'd rather I just go on blind. It sounds fine to me. That's all I care about. Who the hell's listening? All four of you?
Apparently, there are people listening.
No, good. Good. So then I sound like crap when people actually listen.
Well.
What's the feedback from Biondo?
That you sound great.
I sound great. So then it's your head.
Perhaps it is my ear, you know.
Mm.
I thought I straightened that out with the oil of oregano, but who knows?
Oh, mother of pearl.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's been one of those. I don't know.
I don't know either.
We have a situation here. We have a situation.
We always do, don't we? Hey,
yes.
Why don't you tell our lovely listeners who we have on the show tonight?
Well, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but his name is Marco Iacoboni.
Yeah, that's
a good
name.
That's a musical name. That's a name you just wake up in the morning and go, what's your name? I am Marco Iacoboni.
So that'll make three Italians on the show tonight. Can we handle
yes.
it?
Yes. Well, we'll find out soon enough.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that he's written about in his book, Mirroring People, that are going to be playing out while we're working here. For the listeners, there's a lot of pop culture, a lot of pop science out there that we could sort of, as they say, stick a fork in by the top of the hour if you tune in, because a lot of you sapes, you know, you buy that secret crap that I can't stand. And the thing is that they got a little bit of science over there on the woo side. You can't give a woo any science because it's like crack. Then they start walking around going quantum, quantum, quantum to everything.
That word actually makes me cringe now.
Quantum, cereal, quantum toast. Yeah, everything's quantum. The quantum couch.
I think you have a quantum phone there.
That's right. Well, yeah, my phone is quantuming. Yes, everything becomes a Smurfy word, and it's really gone on with some of the things in neurobiology that they've created this whole other language out of.
Yes, actually.
Three pop-ups to the left. Oh, a little hop and a step out there in left field, Soriano. Oh, yeah, little hot dog bastard. All right, we're going. We're going great guns in Philadelphia tonight, but we're 5-5 at Shea.
Better earlier. I should have.
It was 5-1 earlier.
Yeah.
Believe me, if you're a baseball fan and you're on the East Coast, your liver is in your ears at this point from the stress.
Yeah, agita.
It really is daily. I'm going to the game tomorrow night. Weather permitting.
What are you eating?
Mmm.
Oh, I knew you were eating something good.
Chicken pop.
Yeah?
Yeah. I went out of cruising for a snackola about 15 minutes ago, and I knew I couldn't handle anything too cumbersome.
Yes.
So I didn't have time to get a sandwich, so I said, I'll get a chicken pop. So I cruised into Leonardo's, diving across the parking lot as the Mets are blowing the 4-run lead, walking in with the radio in my ear, ordering above the dinner conversation noise.
Uh-huh.
I can care less. I said, one chicken pop to go! And, of course, I got totally ignored as an eco. I could be on fire, and they'll ignore me. And the pounding began.
Oh, God.
On the countertop.
I could just see you doing it, too. I have seen you do it.
Uh-oh. Yeah, and then he wanted to warm it up more. Hey, warm it up more. And then I got no time. I got another. I started just becoming like Kramer. Arms going in every direction. Tippy bartenders. But, you know, this is the world that ecos live in. There's a sort of a slingshot relationship with time. It's either too much time or not enough. We're never quite in the middle of the Goldilocks version of time where it's just right. We're constantly either being chased by or chasing it.
It's true. I was sitting here before and in La La Land doing this and that, and I'm like, oh crap, the show's tonight.
That
was almost late.
Yeah, well, apparently the same thing happened to Alva Perez tonight because Eco was all over the freaking lot walking people, and I just knew it. I knew it. Tomorrow they got another Eco going.
Mm-hmm.
Last night was a Philo, and the Philo, I swear to God, you know, Johan Santana, you know, it's sort of like everything that could possibly be at a disadvantage from a somatic standpoint is happening to the Mets, and they still... Like some kind of a drunken lizard. They still persist on hanging in there. Maybe because they're setting you up for like a more intense and tragic fall from the sky over the next 3 or 4 days. But so far this week, it's been root canal of the soul, but we're still standing here.
It's been worse, but it's also been better.
A lot of the stuff that I want to address with Marco has to do with this sort of not so much mind-body, because that gets old, but it's the psychomotor component of both performance and communication that I'm interested in. His book really gets into the origins of the research around mirror neuron research, so we'll get into that. A lot of Italians represented there. Names I probably defer to him pronouncing at this point. But and basically, you're like, what do you do when you start studying subjectivity? And you put the brain in a bucket and say, how does the brain create this inner world that we have, you know, developmentally and experientially and even interactively? And, you know, they looked at things that were previously sort of undefined. I don't believe it.
Stop looking.
Joe Smith is trying to lose the game, ladies and gentlemen, as I'm what? The Met bullpen has an allergy to getting an easy inning. Every at bat, you have to have your heart and your ears.
Yeah.
And that guy just hit a ball that killed 4 birds on the way to the outfield. It hit so hard. I mean, the fans, I swear to God, I have it on mute, and you could see the silent gasps in the crowd. Ooh, you know, because it's like you always perceive it to be the end of the earth, but they got 4 more at bats. Why would you panic? Because it's the Mets.
That's right. Were you gasping while you were there the other night?
At the game, the gasping ended in the 5th inning when they give up a grand slam to the pitcher. You pretty much just spend the entire next four innings and a half venting at your childhood.
Yeah.
Screaming. I kept screaming a lot of, why? Just at anyone that would listen.
Did anyone listen?
No, I was surrounded by Cub fans from Staten Island.
That's very unusual at the Mets.
I kept asking them why did you choose to sit near me? And it was, you know, the whole thing. They were actually relatives of the opposing team's pitcher. They were having a good old time because this guy hit the 5th home run of his career, and he chose to do it when I was there.
Well, you should feel special. That was just for you.
Apparently it was his family thought so.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Did they freak out or what?
Yeah, they went batshit. I mean,
well, that's good. It's good.
He's a marginal guy. He's kind of an average pitcher, but he's managed to carve out a career. He won a championship with the Cardinals a couple of years ago.
What's his domain?
The pitcher's an auto.
Mm-hmm.
Marquee. Yeah. He kept yelling at the ump early in the game. Both pitchers were yelling at the ump actually. And got a couple of called strikes, I think, just from yelling at the ump.
Oh.
And you could tell he was into it because he just seemed too keyed up for a game. It didn't really matter to his team. And then it came out that his family was there.
Yeah, well, that's got to be fun.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I tried to be somewhat tolerant, but I failed.
Well,
I can't see anything that's going on the switchboard, of course.
Well, nothing's going on the switchboard just yet.
Okay.
So, we'll see.
But in Milwaukee, the Brewers have tied it up.
Yeah. Well, we still have another minute. He should be calling in any second now.
Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
Well, open up a window.
You know, I had a dream the other night about John Adams.
Yeah.
Who dreams about John Adams?
people that watch it on a little loop.
I just hear it in my head all day long.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it is. Sometimes I wake up from these insane dreams, and I don't know. Completely drained from the insanity of my sleep.
What does John Adams represent to you? I'm confused.
I don't know.
Like, what would you and him be doing?
Probably yelling at people. I think I bond with his onto.
Mm.
You know? Oh, we have a caller.
Rejoice evermore!
That was perfect. All right, let me get our sound effect. Hold on a second.
The slippery slag computer decides to open up.
Here we go. Hold on. Here it comes. Beautiful.
There he is.
There he is.
All right. Well, joining us now from another school's location on the West Coast, we have Dr. Marco Iacoboni, is it?
No, it's actually Iacoboni.
Okay. All right. Well,
oh, that's easier to say.
Yeah.
Now, let's clear it up for our international archivers. What part of Italy do you hail from?
I come from Rome.
Rome,
oh,
okay.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the eternal city.
I have some clients that are from the little villages outside of there, and I got my family still probably watching sheep up there in Genoa right now.
Yeah, mine's in Naples going, hey, you left us behind.
Okay. Staying out of trouble. So let's just your book actually kind of raised more questions than it lowered for me, being a neurobiology enthusiast. And the book's called Mirroring People. And since the mirror neurons sort of made their way onto the pop culture radar, of course it's been commandeered by everyone from people studying free will to people studying bioethics and developmental stuff. So how did you first get interested in something that was, kind of previously kind of almost like a, I don't want to say an afterthought, but it was sort of like a minor topic in neurobiology, and all of a sudden it became a real hot subject?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a recent discovery. It was discovered about 20 years ago, and so a few years after the discovery, really few people knew about it. The way I got involved in it was a bit serendipitously, pretty much like the discovery was made, because I was at a meeting, and the discoverer of the cells in the monkey, Rizzolatti, he wanted to do some brain imaging work in humans, and I was already at the Brain Mapping Center in Los Angeles. We met in Prague, of all places. A lot of people think that I come from his lab because I'm Italian and he's Italian, but actually the first time we met, it was in Prague.
Well, okay.
He told me about these cells, and I thought that they were pretty interesting and they had a lot of potential. Initially, I was also a little bit incredulous because, first time you hear this story, you kind of almost, you're in disbelief, because all our ideas about how the brain works is that pretty much like, an engineer can think about an engine, that different parts do different things. These cells seem to be doing a lot of things just in one cell, because they fire when we make an action, like, grasping a cup of tea, but also when I see somebody else doing the same action, even though I'm not moving at all. So they were extremely interesting, but initially I was a bit incredulous. But, several experiments have demonstrated that's a real phenomenon, and it's really a fascinating phenomenon.
Yeah, and again, just for the audience's purposes, what we're talking about here is this mirror neuron discovery is something that it got popularized from the initial research, and now it's been much like memetics was in the 90s when everyone said, hey, how do brains talk to other brains? Oh, the ideas are floating around in the meme stream. There's a lot of abstract, can't stick a fork in it aspects to these suckers. So give people kind of a little tutorial on first of all, how you guys were able to create experimental theories or just like things you could do to test this stuff, and how do you get inside the subjectivity of their function when you say that they're single neurons that work in the flocking behavior? How do you study something that is such a, I hate to say it, a quantum-like communication system where they're kind of gypsies all over the place and they kind of light up and they're kind of a smart system, so they're adapting as they're interacting. So,
right,
how do you How do you trap the fireflies?
Well, you know, you ask me a lot of different things, but let me start with the basic stuff. And the basic stuff is that basically the discovery was made using classical neurophysiological techniques. The way you do it is that to record individual cells in the brain, you have to implant electrodes in the depth of the brain. And what the electrode does is to basically record electrical changes on the surface of the cell. And those changes tell us that the cell is firing, is sending signals to other cells. And so in this way, you can actually, that's the classical way in which you study individual neurons in the brain. The amazing property of these cells, again, is that they were located in this part of the brain that we know controls our actions, so it's the motor cortex. And of course, these cells would fire when the animal was making an action. But they were also fine when the animal was just watching somebody else making the action. So the idea was that you have a very simple way in your own brain in which you can figure out what other people are doing, because you use the same parts of the brain when you make the action and when you see somebody else making the action. Now, actions are really interesting things because they are associated with a lot of mental things that are going on in our mind. Because every time if I grab a cup of tea, it's because I want to drink. If I smile, it's because I'm happy and because I want to show to other people my emotional states. So they're really linked to something that is really deep. And so in a way, we thought that this is a very simple mechanism that evolution has devised to actually solve what the philosophers have called the problem of other minds. How do we understand the minds of other people, given that we can't really get into their minds? And it seems that this seems a very simple mechanism to actually get into the minds of others without any magic.
Yeah, it's difficult, I'm talking out of school here from the somatic standpoint, where you're looking actually at, you know, three-dimensional communication with the body and things like that, where psychology is very map-based and has a lot of filters. So maybe this is something that Professor Val can kind of shine a light on, is that when you're saying that you can sort of externalize or sort of amp up the internal activity of someone's, you know, subjective experience and look at it as an interactive, you know, interface where someone's, you know, using things that you can call communication, but sometimes they're just expression, not meant for a target, but just, you know, an emotion surface or something like that. How do you avoid, I guess, the tendency to, I hate to say mind read, but to sort of associate things in a very linear way, where a smile always means something good. A smile could mean something pretty heinous, but you don't know. How do you do that, you know, with sort of the mute button on it, where you're not in conversation with the person, where you're sort of saying, I'm assuming or I'm sort of hypothesizing what this person intends with this information, with their face. I only know if I talk to them. It just seems like the middle step of asking or interacting or challenging, especially the studies that are done on empathy, they always seem to leave me saying, but, Wilma, I don't understand why we don't just come around the board and just talk to these people if we're not doing, as you say, magic. How do you get past that bridge and say, we're not really in a conversation with them, we're sort of a third party in the room trying to take or extrapolate this stuff out from what's being garnered and we're interpreting it in its own little separate container?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't think there is a lot of interpretation going on. Again, because when I see you grasping the cup of coffee, I activate the same cells that are activated when I grasp the cup of coffee.
The motor part, sure.
Exactly. It's not even, I don't even have to think about it. So it's an automatic, we call it in jargon, simulation of the minds of others. And we run these simulations really automatically. I mean, you're right, in some cases you may be wrong. In some cases behaviors can be deceiving. But first of all, we are really good at reading the bodies of other people, and so we can actually even pick that up. And I think that mirror neurons may actually be involved even in that. But I would say that 99% of cases, you don't really need all these Machiavellian kind of reading of the minds of others, because we do a lot of things in a very kind of default mode, very automatic. We are not really doing all these complex, you know, things that, you know, if you are a politician, you may be doing. But in real life, a lot of interactions occur on everyday actions that get repeated, and they're always the same, and they're very easy to read, especially if you have something in in your brain that does that in such a simple way. So even though you're right that there are situations in which the mirror neuron theory cannot really explain immediately what's going on, I would say that 99% of the cases that happens in your life and my life are not those situations. So these cells, I think they explain a lot of our lives and and when it comes to empathy, it's really about getting attuned to other people. It's not about reading the minds of others in the detached way that you described in your question.
Right. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that in terms of the almost the desire of to be so hyper-objective in traditional science that it's third person in their orientation, this is an attempt to sort of be at 1.5 perspective. Like you have some of the similar behaviors of other people. So it's like, you know, when you're pacing someone's breathing or looking at eye blinks or everything that has to do with these minimal cues, as they call it sometimes with the nonverbal people. This is, again, I'll ask Professor Valenis, isn't there a tendency, especially within the psychological side of this, to sort of almost kind of play match game with those things where crossed arms always mean something, or all these other things that are not other than conscious behaviors, when you're saying, no, there's a biological, grounded explanation for this that has nothing to do with, as you say, the interpreting. It has more to do with being able to understand what the mechanisms are behind these things that we're not really conscious of. So first of all, do you think that that's something that kind of blocks the psychological community from understanding this physiological stuff? And then I'll throw it to Dr. Marco for the physiological side.
Yeah, their map says crossed arms means, that you're trying to block yourself or protect yourself. Absolutely. They just keep running the same old stuff through the mind. And if they're inside the box and they can't see outside, then it's going to be the same old stuff.
And Dr. Marco, I'm just trying to understand if you're going to take this research one step further from being able to isolate it in the brain and understand the functional imperative of the mirror neuron system, how do you get past this first stage of saying, okay, we've isolated the motor aspect, we've isolated the social aspect, how do we get to that bridge in between this sort of a physiological waveform that goes on where sometimes it's this and sometimes it's that, where there's sort of almost like a gray zone where sometimes it's just, baseline physiological housekeeping, and sometimes it's a high-tech, really a socio-physiological phenomenon on the lines of what, say, Porges' research has done with the social engagement system, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a great question. Certainly, one of the problems is that when it comes to moving from the physiological to, say, the psychological domain is that the constructs are very different, and so it's very difficult to actually map one construct from one domain to a construct to another domain. I would say actually in our case, in the case of mirror neurons, we were really good at actually translating the physiological research into some psychological concepts, especially when you, again, if you think of the psychological theories that talk about simulation of the minds of other people, and empathy as a form of simulation. But because these constructs are kind of different, it's not easy to do an immediate and, completely successful translation. But I think that's the exciting thing, is that we see a lot of interdisciplinary work these days. I collaborate with people that are psychologists or philosophers or economists, and it's nice to actually try to go beyond the boundaries of you, because everybody speaks a very specific jargon, and so it's really nice to try to find a common language between different disciplines. But it's going to be a challenge because, again, what you can define physiologically is something that in psychological terms is very difficult to be mapped on because it's the constructs are different.
Yeah, the rules change. I mean, one of the companies that has done a lot of cutting-edge work on this is the Institute of Heart Math out there in California, a little north of you. They looked at the rhythms in the heart, the heart rate variability, which has emotional components, autonomic components, sensory components, all these things coming down, looking at that, at the coherence of that rhythm as a monitor to see into that person's inner world, how that person's responding. So is there some mirror in the body, so to speak, that you can look at things like that would parallel what's going on in the brain with the mirror neurons?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we are looking into the brain, but the claim is really much more, it's beyond the brain. It's really about also the body. And in fact, I mean, we're actually accusing our, you know, community that tends to be very abstract, because people who study the brain tend to think always in terms of the brain as a computer, so in a very abstract way.
Yeah.
But I always think that, you know, the brain, I always say, one of my slogans is that the brain needs the body. I mean, there's no way that you can actually think of the brain without the body. And so, and there are studies that show, for instance, people that look at interactions between patients and therapists,
mm-hmm.
they see that there are a lot of physiological parameters that are just peripheral physiological parameters, like, you know, blood pressure, heartbeat, and so on, they go together, they mirror each other, especially when there is a lot of empathy and connection between the therapist
mm-hmm.
and the patient. So all these things really go well beyond the brain. It really they really get translated into the body. I mean, that's one of the things that I like about it.
Well, let's sashay a little past the moo zone here, where we're talking about things we can stick a fork in, and get into things that maybe other people understand on Main Street, but they might not understand the laboratory. Things like personal space, how someone defines you know, the field around their body, and where they would have the mirror neurons would be monitoring that. So a stranger comes in a room, and the mirror neurons go, "Who the heck is that?" You know, and you know, as people get closer, the proximity, the evaluation becomes much more refined. So, you know, those are things again that you could have it actually happen. You could have it happen from memory. We do a lot of work with the neurolinguistic maps, where you have the timelines of past and future. How much of that is reflected in more mirror neuron activity?
Well, that's a great question, because in fact, very close to the area of the monkey brain in which the mirror neurons were discovered for the first time, and we think there is a big representation of these cells, but we also think that these cells are much more widespread. They're not just in one or two locations. But very close to that region, there is another region called area F4. I mean, the mirror neurons were discovering this premotor region called area F5. And
mm-hmm.
close to F5, there is another region called area F4 that contains neurons that do exactly that. What they do is to map the space around the body. They have properties that are motor properties. They fire when the monkey, say, grasps something, but also they have sensory properties. They fire when an object gets close to the monkey body parts. Say, for instance, if you have a cell that fires for grasping, that cell also fire when an object gets close to the hand of the monkey. And
mm-hmm.
It also fire when you touch the hand of the monkey. So they have multi-sensory responses, both tactile, the touch, and visual, and they have motor properties. And they seem to map really the body around the monkey. And so this region is really close to mirror neuron areas. And so I think that there is a strong connection between these regions in terms of communication. And so you can see how we can actually define physiologically how we actually map the space around the body. And then between, you know, the signals that go on between this region that maps the space around the body and mirror neurons that actually code the actions of other people, you can really get into the details of how our brain codes interactions with others. Because what we do with other people is really to use our body all the time. Because, you know, we shake hands, we smile, we get close. These are all things that we do with the body, and that's really the most important part of an interaction.
Yeah, all those social behaviors, they sort of define that field. And again, this is something that might vary from culture to culture, but you're saying that on a biological level, you're using the same basic neurological equipment, so to speak, to construct this space. And then as things come in and you have experiences within that space, I mean, that some of the stuff in fields like biosemiotics, talk about the umwelt and the ewelt, all those waltz, all those German words, and you get into a real fuzzy zone where you're not so much dealing with an individual, you're dealing with consciousness within that individual. So how do you get past that subjectivity taboo with this work, where you're studying something that's happening within a system and you're supposedly outside the system, but as we're revealing here, there's a lot of mobiation going on, a lot of things mixing and matching. So how do you get past that hurdle where the third-person traditional classical scientists would look at it from the outside saying, fooey, it's just a bunch of motor neurons doing a lot of flocking behavior.
Right. Yeah, I think that's something that we think that because the property of mirror neurons, they actually solve the problem of intersubjectivity. I mean, they really fire together between people. So they really go well beyond, you know, the traditional paradigm of science that looks only at one individual. It is true that a lot of practices in neuroscience are still designed that, such that you study only one person. But in fact, I think because of the properties of these cells, you can go well beyond that. And in fact, we actually made claims that, you know, this is really the neurophysiology of intersubjectivity. When it comes to, for instance, you mentioned the issues of, you know, cultural differences when it comes to distance between bodies. That's easily solved with, you know, with the properties of these cells when it comes to imitation. They're really good, they're really important cells for imitation. And all these practices are really transmitted through imitation. And so there are some cultures in which it's very people tend to really be close to each other, some others in which individuals need more space. And this is something that I noticed when I moved from Rome to the West Coast. On the West Coast, people need a lot of space around their bodies. In Rome, we are, you know, to be very intimate, even with strangers.
A little more affectionate, yeah.
It's completely normal. So, I mean, I think that imitation is a way that really explains how different cultures can create different spaces around the body, even though the physiology that is underlying all these phenomena is the same. So you use the same cells, but then our behavior changes, and that's because imitation transmits the behavior.
Well, to me, it's the classic nature-nurture situation. We all have that by nature, but how we nurture it, you know, is an environmental influence, and you'll get these different cultural, you know, tracks as it goes, which kind of rolls into the next topic. You touch on it in the book, and you get into a little of the controversy, and East Coast around here, it's become a real political football, is the subject of autism, and as it relates to these mirror neurons. Give people kind of a, you know, kind of thumbnail overview of what your research has revealed as far as that goes.
Yeah, well, our hypothesis is that because these cells seem to be so important for understanding the mental states of others, and because they also seem to be very important for imitation, we thought, well, if there is a condition in which there is a problem in understanding the mental states of others and in, you know, having social relations, and also a problem with imitation, that's autism. And so we had the hypothesis that there was one of the core deficits of autism was a hypofunctioning of these cells. And we did some brain imaging studies that did show that in tasks in which the children were doing either imitation or observation of facial emotional expression, the areas that we presume contain mirror neurons were at reduced activity in the children with autism compared to the typically developing children. But also the activity in those regions correlated with the severity of the disease. So the more impaired was the child, the more reduced was the activity. So that's why we call it a biomarker of the disease. Now, the good part of it is that because we know that these cells are very important for imitation, and there are a bunch of studies on that, we inspired people to do interventions on these children, to use imitation-based interventions. And, for instance, Sally Rogers, she's at the Mind Institute at UC Davis, and she's leading a large multi-center trial in which they use these interventions based on imitation. And she was telling me about a year ago when I visited in Davis that they had preliminary data that were really spectacular, that these kids are really getting much, much better. So the nice thing about it is that it inspired these interventions. I mean, we're not part of it. We're just doing the brain imaging work. And these interventions really tell us that the system can really relearn, it can be retrained.
Yeah, well, great. That kind of gives me a little bit of a perspective on how far along this has come because, you know, autism, I just went through it over the weekend with one of the books that came out on the East Coast here that's been promoted by a guy that actually works for the CDC of all organizations, basically saying the thimerosal connection is not valid, and they're making it much more of a public health issue instead of looking at individual cases, in which I find to be a little strange, seeing as every brain is unique. And to dismiss it out of hand, saying there's no connection between putting a known neurotoxin in the brain, or in the bloodstream anyway, would not impair people that have susceptibility or predisposition to it. So anyway, it's one of those things where it's if it's not affecting you and not affecting people around you, you can speculate. But once you have someone that, that touches your life with it, you're always looking for ideology. And how can people enhance their mirror neuron function or work with it in a way that they can develop a better and more keen sense of this aspect of the nervous system, or is that not even possible?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think body practices and especially imitation-based kind of practices are really helpful. I mean, if you start imitating other people and you get, I mean, after my book came out, I got a lot of, tons of emails from readers that told me all these fascinating stories that, about, you know, getting into some kind of attunement with, you know, this imitation, especially in people that do that some training in acting, in which they have to really read the bodies of others and get in sync with those bodies. Imitation is probably a great way and very simple one to boost your mirror neuron activity. That's what I would say, and I think that, you know, also the data that come from the interventions in patients with autism really suggest that. So that would be a simple way of trying to improve your mirror neurons, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've seen a lot of work with right and left brain hemispheric patients where you would, for the right brain people, you would show them pictures of people that they weren't familiar with to entrain the right brain, which deals with novelty, and then the left brain, you'd show them pictures of their family and friends, people they are familiar with, to sort of entrain both maps. And give them much more of a way to kind of make that distinction, because it's one of the primary things I notice a lot with the ASD spectrum kids is that if anything changes in the room, I mean, you could drop a pen or, you know, move something from one, a book from one side of the room. For them, personally, it's a different room. It's almost like there's no fluid environmental kind of tracking behavior that they have to reorient and reorient.
Right.
Kind of like my computer all the time.
Exactly.
I get blocked up easy. There's too much background noise in their heads. So anything, a chair, a loud noise, it's like the startle response comes in, ping, and they got to start all over again and get themselves grounded again. It's what, in my somatic universe, it's called, you know, a poor neuroception. The nervous system's not perceiving itself well, and so you get the proprioceptive, and you get all the other responses all the way up to the higher centers. So how can people just, I mean, there's a lot of literature out there. There's a lot of methods out there. How can people just understand and maybe appreciate the depth that this stuff goes to in terms of its long-term implications for personal and also for collective behavior?
Yeah, I think that, you know, people have a hard time understanding it because it's something that we take for granted. It's something that comes so easy to us, you know, interacting with others, reading the minds of others. I mean, reading the minds is really an expression I don't like, but really getting into, you know, what other people are thinking. It's so naturally that we take it for granted and we don't even have a second thought about it. But in fact, I mean, that's, if you actually pause, if you think about it, you do this all the time. That's the way the book starts. I mean, I try to describe all these everyday interactions that for us we don't even think about. But in fact, it's amazing that how simple and natural it is for us to understand the minds of others. Now, suppose you can't do that because you have a deficit in these cells. What happens is that everything is unsettling for you. And so I can see that patients with autism can. The only way they can really cope with the reality that they don't understand too well, and it's frightening because, again, they don't understand it, is to have something that is completely and something they can control completely. If something changes for them, it's really unsettling. So I think that that's something that for people is going to be not so easy to understand because it's something that they take for granted. But if they stop and they pause and they think of their own interactions and how natural it is for them to understand others, they realize that, in fact, it's something miraculous because it's almost too natural, too simple, too effortless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the danger of that, you know, again, is that people tend to minimize its import because it's so fundamental and so basic. Mm. And again, the explanation gets more and more in-depth, so it's almost disproportionate in the sense that here's this very kind of like concrete thing that everybody does, but yet the science of it is so new, sort of like what DNA science was maybe 20 years ago, and the technology is much faster, and you could look at more aspects of it, look at more sides of it. Like you said, it used to be very limited to sort of external ways of analyzing this. Now you can go all the way down to the watch these neurons and, you know, dancing around inside and looking at brain function and things like that. But the other thing I think that comes up with the developmental aspect of it is that the tendency to pathologize things like autism instead of looking at them as local adaptations of individuals rather than global adaptations of the species. So give me a little bit about that, about how you would look at this from a dynamic standpoint, because a lot of the stuff I've done with this work, it looks at dynamic systems theory and the way that the brain works in a nonlinear way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything that would suggest that the organization of this system has, dare I say, chaotic components to it that might not fit into the linear paradigm that the traditional science would embrace?
It probably does. I mean, we know, for instance, that people who study dynamical systems have noticed that people that, when it comes in really to bodily interaction, there is plenty of the same phenomenon that you see when bodies synchronize that are typical of dynamical systems, with the same properties of dynamical systems, with attractors and all sorts of phenomena that are described in dynamical systems. Now, it's very difficult to translate those concepts that are quite abstract, although they really explain in a very beautiful way really simple phenomena that happened in our life, to go from those concepts into recording single cells in the brain. But I think that eventually we're going to actually bridge the gap, and we're going to actually find that there is a link between these dynamical systems and the way they can describe and explain behaviors and activity at single cell level, for instance, when it comes to mirror neurons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, this is one of those areas where I kind of feel like that I'm not minimizing all your work and all the work that's done in all these laboratories, that we're still really in the foothills of this stuff. And that how it meshes with all the stuff that preceded it. I read a lot of Dan Siegel's work on this topic of interpersonal neurobiology, as he calls it,
right.
and which is another backdoor way the psychologists have found into looking at this without having to get all white coat sciencey about it, but looking at it in real time, in the context of therapeutic situation or a parent child situation, and this my kind of buzzword about of entrainment. So how do you get some of the more spooky stuff, where you deal with old psychological concepts like Jung's concept of synchronicity and things like that? How do you get to that with mirror neurons? How do you get to the point where you're dealing with a collective consciousness, not just the individual dealing with things that present themselves in their external environment?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that what's going to happen in the future is that the research on mirror neurons, it starts really looking at one-to-one interactions. I mean, really, face-to-face, me and you. But it's going to have to move forward and try to capture, and it's not easy because really neuroscience is not really, the practices of neuroscience are not really made for these kinds of experiments. But eventually we're going to have to really look into these more collective kind of interactions and try to find the neural signature. And I bet that mirror neurons have a strong role in this. I mean, you mentioned Dan Siegel. He's really good at translating these neuroscience concepts into psychological and psychotherapeutic concepts. And so I think that he's doing a great work with regard to that. But you're right. Eventually, there are many steps from the research we do and these other constructs. And so I think we either have to change the way we do science, or we have to become smarter when it comes to elaborating concepts. But eventually, you're going to have to have data. And so we're going to have to have a paradigm shift in which we're going to do science in almost in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, like I said, we're on that bridge between the third-person objective, everything fits on the end of a fork, to this much more second-person and even first-person science where you're dealing with experiential data on the same level of validity that you would deal on things that you could measure externally. And that's going to require both a language change in the way that you record, measure, and research it, and also a paradigm shift in the way that the scientific community, put that in quotes, tolerates such lunacy, because they associate all that stuff, that the word that always comes over the heads of anyone that does any kind of body work or anything that deals with these energy systems is anecdotal. So subjectivity bridge, how do you get past the anecdotal stage with this, where how can you extrapolate what you find in one monkey brain to all humans, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's, again, it's really an issue of practices, because, again, the classical way of doing science is that you get to have something that is reproducible, and so you have to, to do it in the lab, and you have to be able to recreate the same situation. Some of these situations are really something that happened in such a complex way that it's not easy to actually do an experiment in classical, you know, classical science. But eventually, we're going to have to become creative enough to do that. I mean, there are some ways. I mean, especially the booming field of social cognitive neuroscience, in which they're trying to reduce the complexity of social interactions in something that is more tractable in the lab. It's a way of at least creating a bridge between these complex things that are often described anecdotally, and you know, scientists kind of say, well, okay, that's just an anecdotal stuff, I can't really confirm it. And the more, you know, traditional and established way of doing science in which you can reproduce a phenomenon reliably.
Well, I wish you luck with this, because it's a very dicey topic. It's got a lot of layers to it, and it really is a complex riddle you're unraveling out there. And again, from someone who, you know, works in I don't know if Professor Val would support me in relative anonymity over here in the East Coast, and I do dip into you guys well for a lot of information and research. It's a book like this. That, and some of the books I've seen, like Dan Goldman's book about social intelligence, it's becoming much more accessible to the public, who are reaching for explanations that the old maps just don't satisfy. So, you know, just for that alone, you're getting it to the surface or the edges of the radar of the mainstream is a big deal. And I know it took a whole career to do that. So I appreciate that. So just to close it up, I just want to get your 90 seconds or just however long it takes you to clear up the number one misconception that people have about your research, about your work, about anything to do with mirror neurons that you would like to remove from the audience's minds right now. Just burn it out of their brains. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, number one misconception, I think it's, I mean, the name mirror neuron is very powerful because it really gives us a sense that, in fact, you're able to mirror the actions of others. But, in fact, it's not just about that. It's more than that. Mm-hmm. Two-thirds of these cells actually do not fire exactly for the same action, the action I make and the action somebody else makes. And so we call them broadly congruent mirror neurons. Why am I bringing it up? Because, in fact, a lot of interactions are not just about mirroring. They're also about doing something that is complementary. The example I often give in my lecture is that if baby cries, you don't want the mother to cry back. Well, you want the mother to do something to console the baby. So she doesn't really mirror in that case. She can read the body and the facial expression of the baby to understand the mental states of the baby, but then she needs to do something else. And I think mirror neurons also do this. In fact, one of the criticisms of mirror neurons is that, well, but you know, you can't just do monkey see, monkey do all your life. You get to do a lot of, you know, interactions about complementary stuff. And in fact, a lot of mirror neurons actually code for actions that are not exactly the same, but they're complementary. So they seem to be really a very flexible mechanism in the brain to for our social transactions, for our interactions. And that's the kind of the number one misconception I want to kind of clear tonight.
Well, that, believe me, that you've done a lot of work tonight just to get it across to our audience. I really appreciate your time, and I encourage everyone to pick up this book, because, like I said, it's one of those ones you're going to keep on your shelf, you're going to keep referring back to. Hopefully you'll be able to pop a few sequels out for us down the road and take this thing to the next level, because I out here in the field, we really appreciate the support from people like you that are willing to kind of test some of these boundaries and come back with information like this. So thanks for joining us tonight on Naked Soul, Marco, and we wish you well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Take care.
Take care now. Bye bye.
You know,
right,
I really wish I could have understood what was going on. My my connection is so bad here; I can barely understand anything. It sounds like Kenny on the on South Park.
I just had a nice little conversation with my friend Marco. That was beautiful.
I have to go and listen to the show now.
Well,
because I couldn't hear
it. Even the host can archive it now.
You know, this effing blog talk.
No, it's so, blog talk is reaching such a saturation point. Their dysfunctional DNA is showing when they have all these problems. But Wow. Well, here's the situation. It's 2-2 to Murphy. We got first and third, no out. The Mets are now down by a run as we switch gears here on Naked Summer. Back to the baseball hijinks. The Brewers are winning 3-1, so the Mets have to win to stay a game ahead. The Phillies are losing, so if the Mets win, they would be tied in the loss column with the Phillies. And I have eaten half my chicken pop. I just got educated by a brilliant man, and no one understood what he said.
Yeah, I really wish I could have actually, you know, heard it live.
Well, hopefully the archive will be clearer than the live feed, and we can all...
Everybody that I polled said that it is clear, so I will listen to it after the show.
Oh, my fucking God.
Easy, this game is making you nuts.
I don't believe what I just saw.
Well...
I really don't believe that. That ball was
late. Look at it.
It was laced into the right field corner. Absolutely laced. Why they didn't run Reyes, I have no idea. And now the Mets are going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. 5-10. Reyes caught off base for the 900.
Well, let's see. It's
No. David Wright is up now. There is a runner on base in less than and two out.
Well, David Wright's the...
David Wright has had a little bit of a hot streak.
Yeah.
But... If it's a home run here or even just ties the game, you will see a chicken dance live on Blog Talk Radio. I predict a flat ground ball or a little pop-up here to end a first and third no-out threat with a line drive to the first. I don't believe how bad their luck is. Oh, my God. Everyone in Philadelphia needs to just burn in hell after that. You don't even show up tonight, and the Mets just lay down like dogs for you. Oh, because strike. I won one pitch. I'm doing live broadcast here in the Met game. So anyway, just to kind of sum up what we learned tonight about this stuff, is that the tendency is, oh, no, the brain, and everyone runs away. But he made the brain much more kind of accessible through observation, through things that you can actually look at without having any knowledge of the neurobiology of it. Just looking at your parallel, other than conscious behaviors, your habits, that everyone else seems to know, but you personally don't tend to understand or see them because you're not tracking them, and it really gives you an idea how this extended self thing works, where everyone else becomes a mirror neuron for you on a global level. It was fascinating stuff. That's why that book is so cool. That Mirroring People book is so cool. It takes the stuff that was kitchen table common sense, puts it in the lab, and comes back and makes it a little shinier. As the final fouls it off for the 2-2 pitch. I really wanted to be happy there at the end of the show.
Well, you might be.
No.
Look, the show is ending in 2 minutes.
Don't humor me. My liver can't take it.
All right. Well,
it's 2-2. It's 2-2 to the final. All right. I will give the broadcast break all the FCC laws here. I'll let the pain come across the airwaves here as he screws this shit up. Here we go.
Tying run at third, 2-2 to right. Meyer just missed at 3-2.
Jeez.
Tension building as we wind down here.
It is.
We only have a minute left. We'll go the music.
We have a minute left.
All right, I'll give you one more pitch. Here we go.
Come on,
David. Do something right here, will you? Boy, just use an odd simile. Close your eyes and breathe.
Oh, God. Look at that. Mother of men.
There you go.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, look.
I don't want to hear it.
Let's play some nice music.
I don't want to know it. I want to kick something.
Well, go kick something.
God, this team has no soul. They don't have whatever depth they can go to torture you. Cue the music.
When the moon hits your eye,
love
I can see you beat the side at the morning.
There you go. Thank you, Marco, for clearing a lot of things up for me, and I'm going to go lay on a block of ice and watch the final two innings. We'll see you next week here on Naked Summer. Travel light, Sapien.
Bye-bye.
Freaking line drive.
Hard to play, tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitar and bella. When the stars make you drool, just like a pastiche, fast rule at some more. you dance down the street with a cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's the morning.